Kansas City, arguably the barbecue capital of the world.
That's Anthony Bourdain. He visited Kansas City back in May of last year for his show No Reservations. He met up with one of our resident food experts here in the metro.
Our barbecue is saucy, thick, rich, saucy, spice, tomato, molasses, it's sweet.
Outside Kansas City, looking in, what do you think people don't understand about Kansas City barbecue and the mentality here?
I don't think they understand how serious it is. People here are serious about their barbecue.
If that voice weighing in on the seriousness of Kansas City barbecue sounds familiar, it should. Bonjwing Lee is sometimes one of our food critics here on KCUR Central Standard. But today isn't a food show, and instead of having Bonjwing talk about food, we're here to talk about him and about his sister, Bonyen Lee Gilmore. I'm Brian Ellison. Today is one of our portrait sessions. This time it's a family portrait of two people who've already had pretty remarkable careers, some of perhaps more than one each, and they aren't finished yet. Bonjwing and Bonyen, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
It's great to have you both here in our studio today. I want to start with you, Bonjwing. Growing up in the Northland, thinking about your future, was traveling the world as an expert on food something you could ever have imagined?
No. For sure not. But we did travel a lot as kids. We were very lucky. My mother worked for TWA, which, as you know, was based in Kansas City.
Right.
And so we did travel a lot. My parents took us everywhere. So
back when airline employees got to travel
great
more
perks,
easily.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And so where do you remember traveling?
Oh, everywhere. We went everywhere. Our parents took us everywhere. Egypt, Greece, Paris, everywhere. Everywhere. The United States. It was great.
Was the food part of what you remember about going to all these places?
For me, yes. Our parents very much wanted us to know that the world wasn't like what we knew here in the United States because they're immigrants. And so everywhere we went, they sort of insisted and tried to expose us to local, what the locals ate. So I loved that.
And so tell me about your parents that you said they came here as immigrants.
Right.
From where?
From Taiwan.
Okay.
They immigrated in the late 60s, early 70s, both for graduate school.
All right. So before you guys were born.
Yes.
And what was your life like growing up?
Well, I think it's pretty simple and pretty normal. But, you know, a very simple and very normal Midwestern life, except for the fact that, you know, being Asian American, it was pretty rare where I grew up.
Did you know other Asian Americans as kids?
Yes, but very few. Very few, few.
I understand your grandparents lived here as well.
They did as well. My mother's side, yeah.
So talk about the kind of the family dynamics. Growing up in the Northland, not many other Asian American families, but here you were with your extended family.
Well, it's kind of I think looking back, it's a unique experience because at the time, it's what your life is. You don't really realize. Just perhaps how different it is from other people, except for the fact that, you know, when I went home, we would eat with chopsticks. But at the school, you know, we'd eat with fork and knife. And we would go back to my grandparents' house after school because my parents both worked. And so I was also very much exposed to my grandparents' sort of cooking and sort of generational outlook. And also, I really am lucky for the fact that we all speak Mandarin because my grandparents spoke to us and our parents spoke it to us. So
is that what you were speaking at home primarily?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. So you were making some pretty significant adjustments every day, food, language, and otherwise.
It didn't seem like it, but yeah. I mean, there was a back and forth. Yeah.
And since food would go on to be such a big part of your life, what do you remember about the food you would eat at home growing up?
Well, it was delicious. It was delicious. It was homey. My grandparents were great cooks. My mom, she would admit that she's not the most patient and therefore not a great cook.
Hmm.
But you know, we were used to different flavors and different ingredients from what we would be exposed to outside of our home. And I think when our friends came over, I think that's when it caused a little bit of tension and sometimes some hilarious instances where they would come over and, you know, they're expecting mac and cheese or whatever, but that's not what my parents would serve.
And would they serve Chinese food that would be recognizable to American consumers of Chinese food?
No.
What was it they would serve that would surprise your friends?
Well, they would do stir fry because they thought that was the most Americanized
version. I just remember a friend of mine coming over and reaching into a jar for what he thought was chocolate cookies, but they were actually dried shiitake mushrooms. Because, you know, and pulling one of those out, I will never forget. And he was like, what is this? What is this?
Did he eat another one after that?
No,
is the question.
No,
no?
For right. sure, no.
I have to think it was quite something then to arrive at in the school cafeteria and find, well, the mac and cheese and the flavorless burgers that are the typical American school food.
Yeah, and I think my sister could maybe also attest to this, but sometimes when my parents would pack lunch, my mother would pack lunches, and they would be, you know, like a tea egg with like a soy sauce chicken
octopus
drumstick or something. And then you'd open it at school, and everyone's looking at you like, what, you know, what is that? I mean, it's a very typical story that I think a lot of people have talked about, but it happens.
Yeah.
It so, actually happened. Yeah.
So you're growing up in this environment, but what did you want to be when you grew up?
I didn't know. I really didn't know. I knew what I thought people expected me to become.
Mm-hmm. Which was what?
I don't know. I think they expected me to be a lawyer or a politician or someone in some kind of civics or...
Why that?
I think partly because I was always a good student. And I think people who excelled at school at that age were just expected to become like a responsible citizen who wore a suit, who sat in an office, you know, who did that kind of a thing.
He memorized the presidents in kindergarten.
Yeah, I was kind of a nerdy kid. I'm still a nerdy person now.
It's when he confesses to being a nerd, I do not see you disagreeing.
No,
Banyan.
Not at all. I mean, look at him.
He is wearing a suit, by the way, for folks, but no tie. So it's a more laid back look.
Yeah, it's a little more laid back.
So what did your dad do for a living?
My father was an attorney.
Okay, so it would have followed in some family footsteps as well.
I ended up doing it, even though my father actually told me not to go to law school. If you can imagine an Asian American immigrant father telling a son that.
Why would he tell you that?
He said that I was too creative for it, that I would be fine doing it, but I probably wouldn't really enjoy it.
Well, and to that end, before you went to law school, when you went off to college, you were not a pre-law student.
No.
You didn't study political science. What did you study?
I studied radio, television, film. And I was accepted to the writing program specifically, so I was more focused on the writing aspect of film, so screenplays and TV scripts and plays.
Did you think of yourself as a creative at that point? Was that what you were going to do with your life?
I think at that point I discovered that it was okay for me to be creative. I'd loved art. I used to draw all the time. And paint, and before college, and I never took a single art class in school. But when I got to college, I met other kids who were also doing very creative things, who had discovered and were allowing themselves to do creative things far before law or before college. And so I think that was the first time when I realized, okay, maybe people who succeeded in school in the conventional sense didn't actually have to do the things that I thought that people should do.
Did it feel like you were leaving something behind when you sort of started to invest time and energy in creative arts?
No. I think the side of me that was always – I'm a very it's very strange. My brain is part very logical. I can compartmentalize very well. I'm a very logical thinker. But on the other hand, I am drawn to the arts, artistic things. I'm a very visual person. No, I didn't feel like I was leaving anything behind because I was still – I did all the things I needed to do well in school. There was still that structure around me. Uh-huh. I think the confusing part was after college, after that structure kind of went away, then you're sort of in this free fall situation of now what do I really do with my life?
And so what did you do right after college?
Well, I moved out to Los Angeles, partly because my sister, or mostly actually I would say because my sister at the time was training for the Olympics. She was a figure skating.
Which we will definitely be talking about here in a little bit.
And she was very good, and she got accepted by some pretty amazing coaches, and the opportunity was great for her to go out there, but she was only 16 at the time, so she couldn't live on her own. So I moved out there, and she lived with me, and I found a job working for a company that designed websites for the studios. We did the back-end website design, and it was a very small company, and very quickly I found myself in sort of a management role at the age of 22, which was frightening.
Frightening, rewarding in any way?
No, because it wasn't what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
No.
How quickly did you decide this is not where you wanted to be?
Day one. Actually, before I even went out there. I just didn't think Los Angeles was a place for me. But, you know, I had studied film and my sister needed out there. So I thought, you know, I'll give it a chance. You know, and a lot of my friends from school who were in the radio, television, film program with me also ended up in Los Angeles. So I knew people there.
Well, and I would think that as a person who is interested in food, L.A. presented you with a somewhat more cosmopolitan range of options than
there were definitely more options.
I-29 and Berry Road interchange.
For sure. Yeah. And the other thing that I was exposed to was a lot of other Asian Americans.
For the first time?
Well, I mean, in college I definitely had, you know, that exposure. But in L.A., you know, I would say the majority of our friends out there ended up being Asian Americans.
And how did that change your life? Why was that significant?
Well, it wasn't except for the fact that just I noted as sort of a demographic change in the scenery. Because, you know, I went to a school that was – there were Asians, but I think there were only about 25-30%.
And you're speaking of your college.
Correct, undergraduate. Northwestern, right. That kind of race never really – it was an issue. I mean, that sort of being in the minority or in the majority never really – but I do remember in Los Angeles – why I say that is because a lot of our food outings with our friends would be Asian. And so when you talk about Los Angeles having great options, it's true.
So how did that come to an end, your time in Los Angeles?
Well, my sister wrapped up her skating career. She decided to go to college at the age of 18 instead of going on. So my sort of – obligation of being in Los Angeles with her ended, and so I decided to go to the other – to somewhere else. I just needed a change of scenery.
And what a change you chose.
I did. I went to D.C.
You went to Washington, D.C. Why?
Well, I had worked for a senator in college. I had interned for a senator, a first-term senator, and I had just gotten close to him and the people in his office. And so when I needed a change of scenery, I called him and I said, you know, I need something else to do. I didn't really know what else I wanted to do. And I said, you know, if you have a job opening, I'd love to come out and go back to D.C.
And what senator was this?
He is now the governor of Kansas.
Senator Sam Brownback.
That's right.
Now the governor. Do you feel like that move to D.C. was a legitimate sort of step in finding your purpose and your identity, or was it really more about just needing a change?
It was both. I would say I'd always been interested in civics and government, and I had interned in D.C. during college. I think the thing that it did for me was it effectively eliminated that career path for me. I realized in my time in D.C. that that was not what I wanted to do.
So similar to when you first moved to L.A., you're
correct.
Like, oh, that's not what
it's
I
just
need
like,
to do.
You know, going off and checking off things and saying, you know, eliminating possibilities.
What were you doing for then Senator Brownback?
I was just a general aide. I did a lot of things, but the one thing that I enjoyed most was I got to drive Sam around. Most senators have a member of their staff that they choose to drive them around, and that was one of the most – because I got to spend a lot of time with him and got to know D.C. very well that way.
What's he like?
Very kind, very honest, principled, and patient. I think principled is the one thing that comes to mind most.
Don't want to get too far off on a sidetrack here, but, you know, obviously Governor Brownback comes in for a lot of criticism,
yes.
as most governors do from at least some. He comes in for criticism from a lot of people. He's the least popular governor in the country, actually, right now in terms of job approval ratings. Does that square with the person that you knew in Washington, D.C.?
It does, only because I know that Sam is one who will – he has his view of the world, and he believes that his election, I think – to a public office is sort of a mandate for him to do what he thinks the people want him to do or they elected him for. I don't want to speak for him, but I think it squares in the sense that he does what he thinks is right. And
it's not about whether people like it or not.
Well, and yes, I would say that he is very, very conscious of the fact he's not out of touch, I don't think, with – I think he's always very aware of what, you know, people might be saying or their opinions. But I think he is very sure of, you know, what he believes in, and he will fight for that. I think that's the thing I liked about him.
So along this path that you've been talking about, along the way, you start writing a blog.
Yes, that happened in law school. So I left D.C. for law school.
Okay.
And I needed some creative outlet. So I decided to combine things that I loved, which is writing, photography, food, and travel. And I started writing a blog.
The blog was called The Ulterior Epicure.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, The Ulterior, because I was hidden. I was anonymous. I wrote it anonymously. I didn't want to be known. It wasn't about me. In fact, I never thought anyone would read it. And Epicure, because I love to eat. That was really what it was about.
You really didn't think anyone would read it?
Well, I'm aware that when you put something out on cyberspace, clearly people read. But I didn't think that I had anything to offer. It was more of an exercise for myself. I mean, I knew that, you know, the internet was an audience, but I didn't really think that it would be become what it has become.
Why was the anonymity important to you?
Partly because I was in law school, and I hadn't, you know, obviously I didn't want future employers Googling my name and finding this ulterior life of mine. Not that it really should have mattered, but, you know, when you're, you know, looking for a job. And then also just because it really wasn't about me. It was about the food. It was just my journal sort of food.
Yeah, well, and for those who haven't seen the blog, how would you describe it?
I think in the years since, it's become sort of a cult blog that is mostly visited by people in the restaurant industry, chefs and restaurateurs and people in the service industry, and also those who are really into food, like really into it. It's kind of inside baseball.
Yeah. Your typical post early on would have been a visit by you to some place.
Right.
And writing in sort of great, some might say excruciating detail about what happened.
Right. So they used to just be reports from dinner tables, like what my experience was like at a restaurant. And this was far before there was, you know, smartphones, so people weren't doing this. It was kind of it was unique for its time. I was taking pictures of the food, which was also very strange for that time.
This was the mid-2000s?
Yes, correct. About 2004, 2005 was when I think I started it.
And so this funny thing happened. People actually did start reading it, a lot of people.
Yeah,
that
was very strange. It did surprise me. Looking back, I don't think it's that surprising anymore because I was sort of compiling this index of restaurants, and it was giving access to people, chefs especially, who weren't, you know, traveling as much as they are now to other kitchens. They were always working, so they never got to travel.
The other funny thing that started happening is people started trying to figure out who this mysterious blogger was.
Right. That's where my anonymity backfired on me. Yeah.
It's
strange
because
people, yeah, they just can't leave people alone. Yeah, I got a lot of crazy stalkers and attention, negative attention.
Say more about that. Like, what was some crazy negative thing?
Oh, I got death threats. I mean, it's crazy because I was just writing about restaurants. But, you know, people just wanted to know who I was, and people who thought they had figured out who I was would hold it over my head, and they would send threats and, you know, all this stuff.
Were people able to figure out?
A certain extent. And I think my veil became rather thin towards the end of my anonymity. I was anonymous for about 7 years. But, you know, the last 2 or 3 years, chefs started figuring out who I was. The huge restaurant eater.com restaurant website or restaurant news industry website, and the editors there knew who I was, and they used me as a source a lot. But they respected my privacy.
Hmm. I'm going to ask your sister, did you know about the blog?
Oh, yeah. We knew. And we thought it was the strangest thing ever because back then nobody was blogging about food. And we would go out to eat with my brother and he would bring a notepad and a pen and a camera. And we couldn't eat until he had all his pictures done. And then he would take notes during the meal. And it was like, this is so weird. It was just so strange at the
time. I still find it weird, honestly.
You can't believe you did this.
Well, I mean, but it's sort of an obsession. I just can't help it, I guess. But I do recognize that it is an odd thing. Now it's just because it's more common that it seems less odd, but I still feel self-conscious when I take out a camera in a restaurant.
So you finally did take off the mask.
I did. And that was after I left the law practice. Yep.
And how did that change this experience for you? You're still doing this, but it's different now.
It is very much different. I think anonymity also allowed me the freedom to write completely openly and freely. You know, now I work a lot with chefs, and so I think my blog has turned more from these sort of one-off writings about a particular experience into a broader commentary on the restaurant industry. You know, there are plenty of people now writing about restaurant experiences, so if you want to find information on any restaurant, you can go to numerous sources or Google them, and you'll find pictures and writings by people all over the world about, you know, their experiences. So I don't feel like what I was initially doing is needed anymore. And so the thing that I think the vantage point that I can offer is having done this for 12 years and having traveled around the world and eating at, you know, such a pace that I have a lot of dots to connect. And it's a sort of overall commentary about the restaurant industry and trends and restaurants that I find more fascinating to me now.
Banyan, are you a food lover as well?
I am, but not in the same way.
Not in the same way? What do you mean?
You know, I enjoy a good burrito or a street taco or a fast food joint, like, you know, fried chicken or something.
You're suggesting you are somehow less discriminating about your food choices?
Oh, yeah. I've never met a meal I didn't like, you know, to be quite honest. But I've traveled with my brother and I've eaten with my brother and the experiences are very different. I've sat at 48 course meals. I don't know. I've lost track of how many, you know, I've been at those meals where you lose track of how many courses there are. and I find it overindulgent and unnecessary, and I would rather just have a burrito and go to bed.
Well, all right. Our listeners are maybe getting the idea that Banzhuang and Banyan are not the same person, and we're going to hear more about that when we come back. We've heard some of Banzhuang's story, when we'll hear Banyan talk about how the same childhood influences led her, by contrast, into a life of figure skating and broadcast journalism, and eventually, liberation. I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back.
This is KCTV 5 News Sunday.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock on the dot on this Easter Sunday. I'm Banyan Lee alongside StormTrack 5 meteorologist. Right now on KCTV 5 News this morning, a serious scare for one Independence police officer when a fleeing driver nearly runs him down, forcing the officer to open fire. Kansas City police.
Okay, so we're making, it's kind of a, I'm just going to let you say it because it's a really long name.
Well, it's a Rainier Cherry Panna Cotta.
Okay.
And Panna Cotta in Italian actually means cooked cream. So it's a little bit like an Italian custard.
Anything with cream is good. Okay, so tell us.
And who could disagree with that? It's Friday on KCUR Central Standard, and in spite of that last clip, this is not a food show, it's a portrait session. And that last voice you heard was the voice of Banyan Lee Gilmore. She's here together with her brother, our occasional food critic, Banzhuang Lee. Banyan, we want to spend some time getting to know you, but first, I guess I have to ask you about the reaction I just witnessed as you were watching, as you were hearing yourself in those clips from KCTV 5 News. Is that weird?
It's a little weird. I'm only less than a year out from my broadcast career after leaving in November. So, you know, it's still very fresh and raw.
And you were laughing, but there seemed to be some discomfort about it, too.
Yeah. I mean, I got into journalism because it wasn't about me. And I always found it very awkward to listen to myself or look at myself or go back and watch videos. So
some of us know about that.
You do?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Because I hate looking at it. Yeah. I didn't know you did, too.
No, hate it.
Really? But and yet your image, your voice, it's in front of thousands of people every day when you're in that job.
Yeah. I mean, I went into it because I wanted to make an impact in my community and to our society. And sometimes I felt the best way to do it was to almost make a name out of myself so that I would have a platform to be able to make change happen.
Well, I want to talk about that and your sense of wanting to make change through something like journalism. But I want to step back, actually way back to when you were growing up. You heard your brother talking about growing up in your family and your community. You were 6 years younger than your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Was the experience different for you?
Totally different. Totally different.
How
Where,
so?
You know, you were asking him about what was it like growing up in middle America, white America, you know, as one of the few Asian Americans. And, you know, he didn't feel like it affected him at the time. It was never really a thing he thought about. But it was always something I thought about. I think because when you're a girl, you grow up with Barbie dolls and Disney princesses, and you have this image of what it is like to be an American girl. And I wasn't an American girl. I lived in two worlds all the time, and I was always very conscious of that immigrant Chinese family at home while trying to be more of an American girl outside of the house.
Your brother mentioned that you spoke Mandarin at home.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like your parents or the rest of your family understood that problem, that conflict you were feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they understood, because how can you really understand when you're not in those shoes? But they did always coach me on how to deal with that when I would express it in a childlike manner. You know, it was always like, yeah, you are different. And my parents never tried to convince me otherwise. They were very realistic about it and always reminding me that, yes, you are different and you're always going to have to work harder. You're always going to have to do better because you are not a white American.
You're saying that was being realistic.
Yeah.
Was it all positive?
Yeah. I mean, I think what came out of it was positive. I think as a child and as a young adult, it was always very difficult because I always saw the world through a different lens of, well, why does it have to be this way, you know?
Yeah.
And my parents were always realists about it and never sugarcoated anything. My brother was always a realist. I mean, to this day, he's still a realist about it. Like, yes, that's the way it is. You need to figure it out. And I did. in a very different way.
Well, how did you figure it out as you moved through adolescence?
You know, I lived away from home a lot starting at a young age because of my figure skating career.
Yeah, tell us about that. You started skating at how old were you?
I was 9 when I started. I started traveling for training when I was about 12. I would travel to Colorado Springs a lot. I spent a lot of time outside of the house on my own, having to figure out the world, you know, being a young adolescent.
Were your parents traveling with you when you took these trips?
Yeah, I mean, they tried to travel with me as much as they could. But I have two brothers at home, so they were always with them too, and they had to parent all three of us. So there was a lot of traveling with me, then leaving me in Colorado Springs to train, and then at 16, LA, and I was, you know, in the middle of my teenage years then. So I figured it out just like I think every other kid figures it out. You know, you go through your experiences, you learn your lessons.
I have to say, let me ask. I mean, at what point did it become clear that, hey, this was not just a passing interest in skating, that she's not just a little bit talented, that she has a real shot at being a world-class figure skater?
I remember being 12 years old and making the decision to leave Kansas City for my main coaching team in Colorado Springs. And I think it was just the competitive nature of myself that my parents saw in me that I didn't want to stop. We had very intentional conversations about, is this what you want to do? Because if this is what you want to do, this means, you know, leaving home and being tutored and not living a normal school schedule.
And that's the choice you made.
That was the choice I made. Yeah.
So as we heard, it was age 16. You pack up your stuff and you move out of your family home to LA.
Yep.
That must have been incredibly disorienting.
As a 16-year-old, I was all about it.
Yeah.
What
16-year-old
doesn't want to move out there and get some freedom? But I moved in with my brother, and he became my surrogate dad for a couple of years.
And was freedom how it felt once you got there?
Yes and no, I think. I had freedom because my parents weren't home every day, but my brother is just as strict. Mm. For the record, just as strict as my parents would have been. So
you're not denying it, Bonchwing.
No, I'm not. I think the hard part for me was being that buffer between understanding what a 16-year-old sort of needs in terms of freedom. But she and I are very different 16-year-olds. We were very different 16-year-olds. Mm-hmm. So.
And you were only 22. It's not like you had a lifetime of wisdom.
No, I didn't, for sure. But I also recognize that she was a different 16-year-old than I was, and she was discovering the world in a very different way. And then, of course, there were my parents who I had to answer to because I was, you know, in charge of her. So that was sort of the stress for me at that time, was sort of figuring out sort of single parenthood at a time when I was still trying to figure out what I was going to do.
Of your sister.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're training. What's a typical day in the life of a 16-year-old figure skater in training?
I would wake up in the morning at, you know, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I would go to the rink and skate for a couple of hours, and I would do off-ice training. I would go back to the rink, skate some more, and then I would do a lot of my homework at night, did a lot of homeschooling.
So, they had tutors for you?
I did work with a few, but it was mainly homeschooling. Online classes were just starting to come out, so there was a lot of that.
And you found yourself recruited to skate not for the U.S. team, but
for Taiwan. Yeah, I had dual citizenship, and my last year, Taiwan approached us because it's not a Winter Olympic type of country, obviously, and it's very common for countries that don't have a lot of winter sports to come to the U.S. and look for kids like me who had dual citizenship, who could skate on behalf of their country. And so I did that for my last year. It was a great opportunity to actually travel internationally and compete internationally on a bigger stage. And so I did that for a year. I was on the roster for Torino because they choose 4 years out so they can train you. And I decided after a year that I didn't want to miss any more college, and it was time for me to live kind of more of a normal life.
So Torino was the 2006 Olympics, but you left figure skating in 2003 or something then?
I was 19.
Two.
2002.
That's about when
that's right.
Was that a difficult time? Was that a difficult decision?
Actually, it was shockingly not as difficult as I thought it was going to be. I think I was just ready. You know, you get to a point, and I think that's the kind of the lesson that I learned at an earlier age than most people do, is understanding transition and knowing when you're ready for something. And when that time came, I knew that I was ready to start a new adventure.
Did you feel, did you feel like you had failed or fallen short in any way?
I'm going to be honest. I think there was a little bit of that. My brother will tell you this. Sometimes my head is in the clouds. I am a big dreamer. I have sometimes delusions of grandeur about life, less so now that I'm older. But as a young kid, I definitely dreamed big. And I always thought of myself as standing on the podium of the Olympic stage, you know. Mm-hmm. And when that didn't happen, of course, you experience a little bit of disappointment. But I learned to move on, and I was excited to start kind of a normal chapter of my life.
And so your normal chapter meant coming back here.
Yeah.
And starting at college.
Yep. I came back here. I went to Metropolitan Community College for a year and a half, did my general eds while I tried to figure out what it is that I wanted to do. And my mom and dad always had this dream of a kid going to the Mizzou School of Journalism. It was actually a very world-renowned school of journalism. And my mom took me there for a tour one day. I went and took a tour of the TV station there, and the rest is history. I fell in love with the program.
The rest is history. You graduated from there, and unlike many in the world of journalism these days, you had job offers right out of college.
I did. I got an offer from in Rochester, New York, for the what they call CNN affiliate or Time Warner Cable News Station in Rochester. Far from home. I loved living far from home. I mean, I loved exploring my world.
This was not a new experience.
No. And so it was exciting. Yeah, I graduated in December, and I started my job January 3rd or something like that.
And did you have a beat? Were you covering certain kinds of stories there?
Nope. I was always a general assignment reporter. Throughout my career, I developed a beat of my interests, you know, politics and healthcare and all of that. But I was mostly a general assignment reporter covering just about everything.
What did you like about being far from home?
I think I've always been very independent, so I think I liked the independence and being able to experience the world the way I wanted to experience it in a very authentic way through my own lens.
And so the next thing you did was to come home.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not in my plans. You know, a lot of people, it's in their life plan to always come back home, and home happened to be a bigger TV market. So I got a job offer and I came home.
You worked for KCTV 5. Mm-hmm. You were there for 5 or 6 years.
6 years.
Six
yeah.
years. What was that like?
I think I learned some of my roughest lessons about life in my TV career. What I loved about journalism was I always got a front row seat to humanity and the world. And I learned a lot about how fragile life can be, because most often I covered people in their worst moments. And I learned a lot about people and just, you know, humanity in our society through that front row seat. But I also learned a lot about myself and, you know, what I was capable of and what I wanted to be in some more of those interests.
You said at the beginning of our conversation that you saw journalism as a way that you could go out and change the world. Mm-hmm. Is that what it was like?
No, it wasn't. Ultimately, I left because I wasn't able to make or tell those stories, the stories that I really wanted to tell. I don't regret going into journalism for a second.
Why couldn't you tell those stories?
It's just the way the industry is shaped up to be, you know.
What's a story you wanted to tell that you couldn't?
I wanted to dive deeper And I think a lot of journalists out there can understand this. I think now in this world, we have alternative news, we have websites, and the capability of journalists is a lot greater. But you have to almost be independently wealthy to be able to do that kind of journalism, to leave the institution and to not be beholden to the highest bidder. And when you work in corporate journalism, when you work in mainstream media, oftentimes you're beholden to the highest bidder. Mm-hmm. And I've gained a lot of great experience, but I just wasn't able to dive deeply into the stories I wanted to.
Earlier in this conversation, you talked about growing up as an Asian American in the Midwest, mm-hmm. having a difficult time sometimes as a kid, feeling different. What was that experience like as an Asian American in television journalism in Kansas City?
It was very frustrating. I will say, while I was very conscious of my differences with my community, I never experienced racism the way that I would hear other people talking about it. And I think it was because I was, very protected and sheltered in my life. When I progressed into broadcast journalism, I climbed faster, and then I hit this ceiling. And I could not figure out why I couldn't get past that ceiling. Until probably the last year of my career, I signed with a big agent. And my big agent was shopping me around, and my agent told me that I'm too Asian to make mainstream media.
Asian? What does that even mean?
I really didn't even know myself. I had to figure out what that meant. And I was told, I was too exotic. Maybe I need to move to the West Coast where there were more Asians. And that was the time when I refused to go on, because I said, no, this is where I was born and raised. I represent part of this community, and I shouldn't have to move from Kansas City to represent the Asian American community. This is my community. But I think there's still a lot of work to be done in the mainstream to understand that our community is diverse and it's not represented in mainstream media.
Well, KCUR Central Standard needs to take one more break. Both Banyan Lee Gilmore and Banjuing Lee have emerged as successful career shifters, maybe more than once. When we come back, we'll find out where each of them has landed now and what the future holds. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're getting to know brother and sister Banjuing and Banyan Lee today in our portrait session show on KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We've been talking with both of them about the various places that life has taken them, and I want to catch up about where they've landed. Actually, Banyan, we were just talking about you leaving TV News last year, almost exactly a year ago.
Yes.
To do what?
I am now the director of communications and marketing for Planned Parenthood Great Plains.
Now that's quite a jump from being an objective journalist to a role with Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, it's been quite liberating. Like I said earlier, journalism gave me a front row seat to my community and humanity. And through that, I always said as a journalist, I'm more of an activist. And I think keeping that quote unquote neutrality just wasn't for me.
Was it? I mean, did you just use the word liberating? I mean, when did that occur to you? Was it the very first day you felt like it was a whole new thing?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. It was the first day at my now job. We were going through orientation and I felt that I truly met my tribe of outspoken feminist women.
Which I want to bring you back into this conversation, Banjuing. You've already shared that you spent part of your career working for Sam Brownback as a senator and as governor, too. He's invested a lot of energy in, defunding Planned Parenthood, for example. Does that make for some awkward family conversations?
Well, I think it does with my parents, not for me. In this current election, I think that politics and personal beliefs have gotten, way exaggerated and extreme. And I quite frankly don't like it. I've always very much valued the fact that, we live in this country where people have their opinions. And I think what's most important when I see being lost a lot is this sort of respect for other people's opinions. I very much respect the fact that my sister pursues, what she believes is right, and she has every right to do it, and I think it's great. I have no problems with, for me, there's no awkward family dynamics at all.
How about for you, Banya?
It's not awkward. We've always been a very outspoken, honest family. We've always talked about what we truly believe in, great debate within our family. But, you know, we have heated conversations. We do. I've always been a very outspoken person.
But I think it's that willingness to engage.
To engage, on
a,
right.
On an informed level that it doesn't just devolve into, you know.
Mayhem.
Yeah, or just, you know, caricatures.
No one's ever thrown the mashed potatoes across the Thanksgiving
table.
No.
Do you two, I mean, we don't have to have a political debate here on the show, but do you find yourselves disagreeing a great deal?
We disagree on a lot of things, but I think we also overlap on a lot of things. I think we're the prime example of perhaps two people sitting on opposite sides, as society would have us think it, but realizing that we have a lot more in common in common goals and interests, just maybe perhaps different ways of thinking about it or different ways of coming at the problem. But I think it's what's important is to realize that overlap and to help, you know, work towards that together.
Banyan, your work with Planned Parenthood, do you feel like it's a good fit for you in terms of what you're doing, communications, marketing? Are you in the right place?
I'm so in the right place. I've never looked back since I started in November of last year. I love it. I mean, we talked earlier about the racial divide in TV news. And it really very much translates into my work today because, you know, access to reproductive health care is very much a racial and socioeconomic issue. So I love every day. I mean, I can truly go to work every day and say that I am fulfilled 100%.
Wow. We all wish for that. Yeah. Banjwing, are you able to say that these days?
I am.
You are
happily.
You are still writing The Ulterior Epicure, but that isn't what's making you a living.
I think that's been a misconception in the life of my blog, is that people think I left being a lawyer to become a full-time blogger, which is, for anyone who out there who writes a blog knows that that's just an absurd concept, that you could, to make a full living off of writing a blog is nearly impossible.
Yeah. Oh, that were so. But
and
no.
I never made it. In fact, if you go on my blog, there is no advertising on there. I don't make a single dime. If nothing, I spend a lot of money to provide the sort of material that I write on my blog, which is not, you know, it's not intentional. It's just I'm writing about what's happening in my life.
Which are things you want to be doing.
Yeah. But no, now I have been a full-time pretty much photographer for the past 5-6 years almost.
What kinds of photographs do you take?
I would say that here's where my sister and I are very similar. I would consider myself more of a photojournalistic photographer. I've always been interested in documenting and systematically documenting things, and more so telling stories with my photos. They're not meant to be just beautiful, although I do try to make things look attractive because I'm very visually oriented. But it's more about documenting food. I mostly photograph travel and food, and I love doing it.
So who's buying those photos?
Sometimes magazines do. I work with a lot of chefs. I've done a few cookbooks. And I just got back from a 20-day hunting trip where I was photographing with a chef for 20 days out in the wild. We were just hunting elk and bear and deer, grouse, fly fishing. It can be anything. And then, you know, I could be photographing in restaurants as well.
Were you actually hunting along with these folks?
I was out there. I don't have my hunter's license, so I wasn't actually shooting. But I did fly fish. I love fishing, mm-hmm. So I did participate in that. But
So it's taking you to some places that you get to experience new things. A lot like what Banyan experienced.
Yeah, and I pinch myself. I cannot believe the experiences I have. I really cannot. I wake up in a different country sometimes every other week, and it's incredible.
You know, circling back to where we started talking about food, you do take pictures of food.
That's
a lot of what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the majority of what I do.
What goes into taking a really great photograph of food?
That's a good question. I don't know. I just take what's in front of me and I see it the way I see it. I've tried to figure that out. I think my viewpoint on photography is that anyone can really take a great picture if you just know how light and color works. If you figure out the mechanics of a camera, it's really not that hard. Yeah. And so it's just about getting proper exposure and all that, you know.
It's really not that hard, and yet so many of us can't do it.
Well, I think that the smartphone has made people – given access to people to take better photos than they probably would have with a camera. I learned to take pictures on a film – single lens reflex camera, old school. So where you had to learn depth of field and all these things, ISO and things like that. So I think, you know, that's when I say that learning the mechanics of a camera is really important.
And what would you say inspires you the most of all these things that you have the chance to go out and take pictures of?
Surprisingly, it's people. I love the people I get to work with and the people I get to meet and their stories. And food is sort of just like this ancillary thing that it's a common interest among most of the people I work with. But it really is the people. It's the people. People are great.
Yeah. You know, I asked you both before the show if you'd ever done a joint interview like this before, and you never had.
No.
No.
Do you feel like your lives have really been so separate?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are similarities, right? My brother taught me to always pursue what I wanted to do, what I really, truly wanted to do. He always told me when I was miserable in news, just leave. Do what you really want to do. Go find your passion. In that sense, we have commonality. We were willing to step away from pretty cushy jobs to pursue our passions, and it's worked out for us.
Mm-hmm. I think the thing is, my sister has always been willing to take more risks than I, though. I think I'm far more risk averse, and I sort of always I did for many years fall into that thinking of I should do what society probably expects me to do, you know, whereas my sister never did that. She was the figure skater. She homeschooled. She went to journalism. She did all the things that she really actually really wanted to do. I played it safe. You know, I went to law school. You know, very predictable, you know.
Except that you did these things and then you tried something else.
I did, because I quickly realized that I was just doing it for probably not the reasons that I should be, you know.
Are there ways that you guys feel like you have been an influence on each other?
Yeah.
How has your brother influenced you, Banya?
He taught me the rewards of the reward you get when you pursue your passion.
And I find that so ironic. But
why?
Well, just because I think I was telling you something that I probably should have done earlier in my own life.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Yeah.
You're projecting the advice you should have given yourself.
Well, I was giving it to myself. I just wasn't willing to take it. Whereas I was telling her, you know, I see this happening to myself. You should do it while you can still.
Are there ways that your younger sister has influenced you?
Oh, sure. In many ways. She makes me realize that sometimes you just need a little chaos in your life. In a good way. I mean, you know, I think growing up with, being with her in Los Angeles especially, you know, teaching me how to live with someone who was very different than I was, and learning that some people reach their life, goals and have different life goals than you do, has taught me to really think, to consider the other person's point of view.
Yeah. You both seem like you are doing what must come pretty close to your dream job at this point. You both seem incredibly happy in the place that you've landed.
Finally.
Yes.
Yes.
Do you wish that you could have found this at 24 and been doing this your whole life?
Me, no, because at 24 I was doing what I wanted to do at 24. I think I've just been incredibly blessed and lucky to have I think I still consider myself young, so I've been really lucky to be able to always work in a place that I've wanted to work. There were a few years where I didn't, but it was worth it. I'm here
now. How about you, Banchoy?
For me, yes, of course, I wish I were doing what I was doing, what I'm doing now at 24, but I also realized that there was no way that could have happened, that what I'm doing now is only made possible because of all the strange things that I did in between 24 and now. So, yeah, I wish, but I know that that's not how life works.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Banjuing Lee and Banyan Lee Gilmore, for being with us and for sharing your stories. It's really been a great pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
This portrait of these two can also be found online, including an actual photograph by KCUR's Luke Martin. All that and audio of today's show will be online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can find all our past shows there, too. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTSBrian. And folks, this is actually my last show as the acting host of Central Standard, which is good news for you. It means Gina Kaufman's coming back, adding another job to her other new full-time job, which is being a mom. You can look forward to hearing Gina on Monday. I can tell you from my time here this summer that this job is a lot of hard work, but it's exhilarating work because, as I've come to realize, it's not just about the learning and the studying and the writing. It's about the listening, The headphones are more important than the microphone in this job, and listening to the stories and the calls and the questions has all been a great privilege. I'm going to read a long list of names, as I do almost every day. Know that these folks are the real voice of Central Standard, the producers and staff who give the show its story and its life. They're an amazing team, and it's been a privilege to be part of it. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and Fridays by Jen Chen. Our team also includes Suzanne Hogan and Andrea Tudhope, and intern Raven Brooks. Linda Scher is our announcer, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. By the way, I'm not really going too far. In fact, I'll be here a couple days next week. But for now, I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend.